appropriations, capital improvement projects approved by the voters for approximately $30 million, nor smaller grants and expenditures for lesser projects. The $500,000 plus dollars I have listed for research and planning purposes to guide the future of correctional policy has now been spent. We now have the results of those work efforts. It's time now for the legislative and executive branches of government to take make rational decisions based on the results of these several projects so that the taxpayers receive a fair return for their investment. It is not time for emotional discussions which ignore the fruits of these projects. In December of 1978, the Justice Center sponsored the Legislative Conference on Corrections. We had as speakers at that conference members of the state legislatures of Hawaii, Oregon, and Florida, as well as Mr. Richard Pettigrew of the White House staff. As far as I know, we were the first state in the nation to sponsor such an interstate legislative exchange of problems and potential solutions concerning corrections. The center has also conducted two annual statewide criminal justice conferences to discuss justice issues, the last having been completed just last month. At the earlier conference, Mr. Pettigrew, fresh from the White House, warned that to bring reform to our correctional system would require boldness and a determination from our legislators that correctional changes must be made. He stated clearly that these changes would require legislative courage at a time when the public wants relief from being further victimized by criminal and deviant behavior. To continue to provide for more of the same, that is, more prisons, more cells, more restrictive punishments through harsher sentences, would not only be ineffective in reducing the crime rate, it would add a further very expensive burden to the taxpayers. It is my opinion that taxpayers are being twice victimized by our present system. We have no difficulty identifying the actual victim of a criminal act, but the community of taxpaying citizens is also being victimized by having to pay for the extremely high cost of incarceration. An example might be found in the present $30 million bond issue for new institutions in this state, each of which, on the adult side, is a replacement facility, not providing new prison space or beds, and in the present $25 million Division of Corrections budget. I suggest that it is now time to make critical correctional decisions, and your opinion, those of you on this committee, will play a crucial role in the decision-making process. As the sentencing provisions of the new criminal code will reflect, there is a cry to get tough on crime and criminals, but at what cost? How much are you or the taxpayers willing to pay in order to be tough? Will getting tough reduce the crime rate? The evidence available to us from national level research is that building more prisons has absolutely no effect on the crime rate. This is no longer a liberal versus conservative argument. We have to make decisions on facts, what we know as opposed to what we think or feel may be right. I like to think that I'm neither a flaming liberal nor an arch conservative. The business that you are about calls for the same logic, but further requires that you both represent and lead your individual constituencies. On emotion-laden issues, your job may not be an easy one, as Mr. Pettigrew warned. The two master plan summaries I've prepared for your use makes it emphatically clear that the traditional answer to solving correctional problems, that is, in building more prisons, will cost Alaskans multi-millions of dollars. That may be okay if the taxpayers are willing to take on the additional burden. On the other hand, we have some indications at hand which demonstrate that our present correctional system, that is the institutional side of corrections, is right now at full capacity and in fact is overflowing into the Federal Bureau of Prison System. At the same time, the new criminal code will cause an additional and probably severe demand for additional institutions. Estimates of the impact of the new code range as high as a 50% increase in our institutional space requirements. That is a doubling of our present capacity due primarily to the elimination of parole, more punitive statutory good time provisions, the elimination of meritorious and extra-meritorious good time, and the limiting of judicial discretion for repeat offenders. For example, Charles Campbell, Director of Corrections, tells me that under the new code, 40% of the offenders now on probation would not be eligible for that sentencing alternative under provisions of the new code. This is in spite of the fact that probationers in Alaska have only a 12% failure rate, half of which are due to technical, not criminal, violations. These figures would tell any rational man or woman that we can afford to effectively supervise more people on probation, not fewer, and that this can be done without increased risk to the public and a tremendously high cost of incarceration. Again, logic and economics have provided a clear message for us. I am not proposing, nor does the master plan, that we let more people go, that we soften our approach to crime, or that we further frustrate the hardworking law enforcement officers in this state. I am suggesting, as does the correctional master plan, that we redirect our efforts, our money, our personnel, toward effective and close supervision of our low-risk offender population in other than additional prisons. In 1974, Alaska had approximately 400 prisoners locked behind bars, in-state and out. In 1979, we have approximately 800. In a short 5 years, our prison population has doubled. There is no evidence that this rate of escalation will decrease. There is a substantial probability that it will, in part, increase. Since our system is now full, where will you put these people? We should make every effort to prevent crime, and we do have reasonable means available to help us to do this. How much money and effort are you willing to put into crime prevention efforts? We should make every effort to catch and convict more criminals and delinquents. How much money and effort are you prepared to direct toward increased law enforcement effectiveness? We should correct the behavior of those caught and convicted. Here also, more money is required. For although we may prevent some crime and catch and convict more criminals and delinquents, we must, by the laws that you, the legislature, have passed, supervise and provide custody for these people. The question here is not how much money and effort you are willing to spend, but how you will direct that it be used, for it must be provided if you are to avoid a future, which I might otherwise predict, will be one of both inmate writs and possibly riots due to inadequate and unconstitutional care. The state of Alaska is at a crossroads. I could more fully outline two potential future scenarios had I more time, depending on the decisions you make with regard to the future of corrections. One scenario involves the building of several new prisons in Alaska, costing multi-millions of dollars for the purpose of locking up, in a traditional sense, the offenders that our new criminal code will provide. The second scenario reflects the realities of economics, which might better be directed toward merely remodeling our present institutions to provide for approximately 200 new prison beds, but more importantly, adding up to 222 new correctional staff at a cost of roughly $6.4 million and directing them to develop strong alternatives to the prison. This scenario should include a strong restitution and community service concept to literally allow offenders the opportunity to earn their way to freedom in economic terms. By putting our 800 and more incarcerated offenders to work doing public works projects, perhaps including the construction of new jails and other public facilities, particularly in rural Alaska, the taxpayers can receive a measure of relief from the tax bite, and offenders can benefit from learning to complete honest work. We should pay them a reasonable wage, and they in turn should reimburse the victim and the state, keep their families off of welfare, put aside savings toward release, and in fact be released when they have earned their way out of jail. The cost of even 222 new correctional personnel at $6 million is not half the probable cost of even one new medium security institution. Where do you want to put your money? A third possible scenario might be that we do nothing. That would mean that we do what has traditionally been done in the field of corrections, that is, become reactive to events, traumas, as they occur. We have now before us the opportunity to be proactive by paying close attention to our past 3 years and $500,000 worth of expenditures on research. As I see it, we have the three choices I have just cited, any one of which you can, as a legislative body, select. But you have no choice in whether or not to make a decision. Your decision this session will have long-lasting repercussions for the state. I hope you will carefully weigh the alternatives, and I think that you will find that the talented and capable justice professionals that we have in Alaska will be most anxious to provide you with information necessary to making that decision. I compliment you on holding these forums so that you might receive information critical to your work. I also want to thank you for inviting me to speak, and from there I'd be glad to answer questions. I should perhaps apologize for the formalness here. I wasn't sure of what sort of forum this might be.
Let me start on my, just with kind of a general question. I know you didn't write the master plan somewhere, so I don't think this is in view, but there did seem to me to be rather a lack of emphasis in that summary on protection of the public. Now, as someone has stated, at least this person behind bars for whatever period of time it is, he's not out robbing somebody's house, or, you know, or holding up somebody on the street, or doing all these other things. And I think it's fair to say that the public is entitled to protection, to reasonable security in their lives and property. We've heard all the good figures about probation. Of course, this master plan report is full of all these so-called community alternatives.
Yeah.
One thing that doesn't seem to have been addressed, though, is this 12% rate, which everybody's very proud of, really, to some extent, deals with a rather select population. And it's, the more you expand that population, instead of putting people into incarceration, then the greater the likelihood that that rate is going to increase, if you're going to have 25% or whatever. So, with those 2 points, the protection of the people's lives and property, the general public, and this possibility of changing this rate if we expand the scope of this probation and community efforts. Would you want to address either one of those 2 points?
Sure. I think it is difficult to extract from the plan what they intended in terms of public safety. But I think what's underlying that approach is the very strong feeling that there are a number of people presently incarcerated who do not need to be incarcerated, in spite of the wisdom of our judges. Through effective and close supervision, these people can function in a less than secure setting. Now, that doesn't mean that they're free on the streets. It doesn't even mean they're in work release status. But it could mean, for example, if we were to double the capacity of the Palmer Adult Camp, we can have people function there at a much lesser cost than at the Juneau or Eagle River, for example. So the benefits, what they're trying to tell us is that we're far too security-oriented, that we emphasize that, overemphasize that, and it's costing us literally millions, and it will continue.
Wouldn't the average taxpayer in this state be willing to pay an extra $20 a year if he was much more reasonably secure, and reasonable extra security? He's not going to be mugged, assaulted, have his house broken into and robbed or any of those things. How much would he actually, he probably wouldn't hesitate to pay an extra $20 or $50 a year. It would be cheap insurance.
That's okay, and I agree. If the taxpayer is informed about the decisions and he's given the alternative and told what the costs are, then I am 100% for it. But that hasn't been done. And what I'm really concerned about is that the new criminal code is a controversial issue right now, and no one really has a solid handle on it. But the highest estimate is that we're going to double our prison population. If we just took that figure I cited a bit ago, about 40% of those now on probation who would not, there isn't any doubt, they will no longer qualify for probation. There is no doubt. That can't be disputed. That means that if the judge cannot put those people on probation and he decides to sentence them at all, the only alternative is to send them to jail. Well, if we have 800 people in jail now and we increase that number by 40%, you can see that immediately, as soon as that code goes into effect, we need another institution, because there isn't room for 200, 300, 400.
I think you understand that. Raising a little bit of an issue, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was raising the issue of what appears to me to be the sort of the bias in this thing. And I think it's fair to discuss, you know, the alternatives. But the bias seems to give too little relevance to the security of the public, number one. And secondly, it seems to assume that this very good recidivism rate we now have on probation would continue if we did adopt this alternative count, which I have doubts about.
Yeah.
Because then you'd have many more people on probation if this were followed, right? And I don't know if that 12% rate would continue. I suspect it would climb to 25 or 30. I don't know that, but that isn't addressed. It was a basic assumption in this thing that this good recidivism rate will continue if we do adopt these community alternatives. And I suspect that's not true.
Well, 2 points. One is that an increased probation rate will not continue because the criminal code won't allow that to happen. It's possible to continue with first offenders or first convicted offenders.
Well, that's what we're talking about. Basically, I'm not referring to the second offenders who are under the presumptive sentence. I'm
right.
Not referring to those at all.
Okay.
But the thrust of this thing here is we use more community alternatives, as they call it.
Yes.
We send them, we put them on probation, we put them in group homes, we put them in halfway houses, we all this other thing.
Right.
And I just don't, I think that's a very optimistic.
I can't disagree, you may be right.
Yeah, just questioning, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Charlie, I'm not, you know, I'm not familiar with all the recommendations in the, you know, master plan. But in the development of the alternatives, such as one being discussed now, are these alternatives or versions of them in effect in any other jurisdiction? In other words, the idea of public protection and crime rate, recidivism, or other measures, are there existing examples where we might use with some reliability in making a judgment about what might happen if we did adopt one of these alternatives? Are there jurisdictions that have put into practice something similar to what's being recommended?
Yeah, there are several that come to mind. The best, probably the best correctional system in the nation right now is in Minnesota. And Minnesota has instituted this concept. Ironically, another state that is following the same route is Oklahoma, which traditionally was one of the most backward systems until about 5 years ago. Ned Benton went in and took it over. To give you an example, in Oklahoma, Benton went in and bought 10 motels that were bypassed by new highways around the state of Oklahoma. And he just flat purchased them, much like we did with Ridgeview, except as a lease. He didn't modify them in any way, and he put, depending on the size of the motel, but there were anywhere from 50 to 100 inmates placed in those facilities as alternatives to the prison, and then he staffed them with his regular correctional staff. A great number in each facility go out on work release or education programs and so on. If they foul up, they're first of all restricted to that facility. If it's serious, they go back to the regular prison. There isn't any doubt what's going to happen to them if they mess up. And occasionally they've had serious repercussions. Somebody's robbed somebody or beat up somebody, serious injury. But they did a good job in informing the public that there would be some risks and that they couldn't expect to have 100% success. Anyway, that's another model. Oregon has recently passed a Correctional Reform Act, a Community Corrections Act, and they're implementing the same kind of program there as an alternative to new prison.
One other question, Chairman.
You or Mr. Adell, you know whether the data are available that would show whether persons who are in either work release programs or people who are on probation and parole and under supervision for the sentence, before the sentence expired, have a significantly different rate of recidivism than those people who remain in incarceration basically until their time's up and go back out in society. Is there any difference in those rates, or are they about the same, or if you don't have that information, is it available someplace the committee might examine? The reason I ask that question is that at any rate, unless you lock people up forever, it seems to be a risk occurs, you might say, when they're released. And while it's true, I suppose, the longer you keep locked up, the safer you are. I think that all of us acknowledge that a good percentage of the wrongs that happen that are brought to justice, so that it is eventually quite economics, but are there ways that the data that would be available would be useful in determining whether just better let them out again and see what happens, or to try the idea of supervision?
To answer your question about the research, there have been some studies done. None of it has been replicated, so that we can't yet trust the results. In some places, it's indicated that that those who go out on work release or some sort of community supervision first have better, more successful experiences and don't come back at the same rate as others. The difficulty is that those who are released directly from prison, at least the assumption is that they don't have any assistance to get them restarted, so that the failure rate is higher. So it's difficult to compare the two groups. Those that get work release have an advantage, and their success rate appears to go up in comparison to those who just flat hit the bricks right out of jail. So it's a difficult area to try to measure. Some states, though, if this is any help, some states are passing or attempting to pass legislation which requires that, I believe the figure is the last 4 months an individual sentence must be spent in a community release program. And in those states, the thinking is that corrections has an obligation to get that person ready to go back out in the street. In fact, if he fails during that last four months of his sentence, then he can be brought back and he'll serve the rest of his time. So it's a test situation, but without it, well, I've seen the impact here in the paper I did a year ago, talking to the parole board people. I found out that, it used to be about 40%, inmates were serving about 40% of their time before parole, and that figure's gone up. I can't remember exactly what the percentage is now, but it's gone up. And one of the reasons for that was that they no longer had a gauge to measure how people were doing prior to their actual release. So they're much more conservative in their opinions, and people were serving more time. That also contributed to overcrowding our institutions to some degree. So they need a gauge. The master plan folks propose a statute which would empower the parole board to order that an inmate be granted work release prior to the date they intend to let him go. That's a little controversial. I don't know whether we're ready to do that or not. But I guess, you know, to summarize on that, it seems to me that we have to prepare a man to get back out on the streets. And if you just open a door and let him walk out, I think we're playing with dynamite. We're asking for trouble. He hasn't got a place to live. He hasn't got an income. He's got, you know, there's been no community resources tapped unless he's done it on his own. Right now, corrections is not doing that. There are a few people in a contractual halfway house here in Anchorage. The master plan says corrections ought to have a facility for 45 people in the Anchorage area and 24 in the Fairbanks area in the halfway house program. By the way, halfway houses, I prefer to call them community treatment centers, but they don't have to be halfway out. They can also be people coming into the system, which they do in Oklahoma. They can also be used for people on probation or parole who are getting into trouble, but don't necessarily have to be locked up. They can be put into this halfway house and supervised. The courts can use the halfway house in lieu of incarceration if they wish to do that. So there are many ways to use a community treatment center other than just letting people out.
No, I'm just trying to mention the guy who robbed our shop twice was sent to a halfway house in Fairbanks.
After?
No, he was sentenced to. And of course, he never got there, but he got there and then turned around and walked away. He disappeared.
Yeah.
And you know, you don't like that your personal experiences influence your legislative judgment, but I'm sure I wasn't the only person this had happened to either. And that, you know, it didn't make me feel very good about it. You might have been locked up in a very thorough secure, you know, facility for a while. Ms. Buchholz, excuse me, I apologize for breaking out on you.
That's all right. Mr. Rendell, you mentioned that most people in prison go through their 40% of their time before they're even given parole. But, and Reverend Lyons came here this morning and he said one third definitely has to be spent before they would even consider a person to be let out. And then he has other conditions that they had to go by, and I think some of them were arbitrary as far as I could determine whether they could consider that an individual could be capable now of walking into, you know, the society, back into society. And did you spend much time with, working with the parameters that the parole board can deal with, considering the release of an individual? I couldn't ask him too many questions because I really am not familiar with what they do exactly, but from what I have heard, that there are more personal convictions devoted to the release of a person rather than maybe some criteria, although they said they had 15 of them.
Yeah, when I started working in corrections 9, 10 years ago, I guess, my first job was as an institutional parole officer. That is, I prepared the documents that were presented to the parole board, and I'd make recommendations. This man should be released and said why, or this man should not and said why, and so on. So I had early experience with the parole board. It was my opinion then, and it still is my opinion, based on what I hear now about how the parole board operates, that it's a tremendously arbitrary action. That many of the decisions are made on gut-level opinions of the individual parole boards, which may not have but little relationship to the facts and evidence presented to the board. The recommendations are that we have a professional board, that is, professional people. That may help, but there aren't any guarantees. It's also recommended they be full-time. I have serious doubts whether that's necessary with our small system. They also recommended that we pay them equivalent to our Superior Court judges, and I think that's going a little too far. I'd be one of the first to apply if that happens.
But since most of these people are civic leaders or people who are recognized by society to be responsible people, yet you say that they, some of them are not qualified probably or whatnot. Do you, I have read your master plan, but do you deal in any kind of a training recommendation for training program for provosts, how to address the problems and, you know, what they need to do to qualify or to really upgrade their knowledge of the system?
Well, what they recommend is rejection totally of our present parole system, and that we hire, first of all, highly educated professionals. I think one should be a lawyer, the other a behavioral scientist of some sort, psychologist, sociologist or something, and I've forgotten what the third recommendation was. But anyway, three professional level people. So what they're saying is we want highly qualified people, the same as we get supposedly highly qualified judges now, so that we don't have to worry so much about training them. The other part of the answer to your question is that there are some things that could be utilized from other states. I know Sam Tribbett is very interested in a parole guidelines project, which Oregon has instituted, and that seems to show a great deal of promise. If that were instituted here, it would take some of the discretion away from the parole board, because it sets up a very mechanical sort of tool that assesses their risk, their background, just looks at them in a composite sort of way with maybe a list of items. And that may sound very simplistic, but it has been tried. The Manhattan Bail Project in New York, the Vera Institute there, the Federal Parole Board has been working on parole guidelines concept for a couple of years now. It seems to be fairly successful. So I suppose we could go either way. We could get a professional parole board and hope that the people there are better than what we have now, but I don't know if that's the answer. I'd rather put more faith in development of these parole guidelines. And we've got our neighbors to the south here to help us with that. There's no reason why we can't come up with that. Matter of fact, there's a grant I think the parole board has right now to develop those very guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is CJPA.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Thank
you.
I have two other points, Ms. Mandel, since you're really in a little broader field than just corrections, as I understand. And you were saying a while ago that the two things, of course, in addition to the corrections side, yes, crime prevention and law enforcement, you could try to improve both of those. And I certainly agree with you that those would be highly desirable. I think the last figures I saw, only in all those thefts, only 17% of the cases was an arrest made, much less a conviction. And so what could we do as a legislature in terms of the crime prevention or in terms of improving the law enforcement? Do you have any recommendations? So far, all we've talked about is what we want to do after we get them convicted.
Right. I think in the crime prevention area, I have to beat my own drum a little, or our drum, I guess, but the center was given responsibility for doing some crime prevention work and community education work. And Doug Berry, for example, has done quite a bit, little crime spots that are aired on the television news, short stories, even some half-hour and longer.
The ones they don't leave the keys in the car?
That sort of thing, yes. Doug's tends to be a lot more sophisticated, I think, than that. That's one approach. I think we can do a great deal there. I think we can do a great deal in public education. The Justice Center 4 years ago prepared a model high school curriculum that could be used in the Anchorage School District. And in fact, they did use it for a while. I don't know if they still have it or not. We found that the biggest problem was not developing materials to teach the kids. It was educating the teachers about the correctional or the justice system. Anyway, that's another area that I guess what I'm saying is that crime prevention is really public education. That's what it really translates to. Informing people about crime rates, about what they can do to protect themselves. It also involves working with what are these, community councils, that sort of thing, to work with them in their, you know, neighborhood watch kinds of things, identification of material that they have in their house. There's just, the National Council on Crime Delinquency has taken as a number one project for the next few years, a national crime prevention campaign. So we have models and materials coming from the national level now, which would be of assistance too. I think in the area of crime prevention, and for me at least, it's directly related also to alcohol abuse, we could be doing some tremendous things that we haven't even begun to touch. It does take a little money. You have to have the media production techniques and equipment available, but not that much. I think we get a lot of money off of it. So that's crime prevention. And law enforcement, I think also education would help a great deal. We for 2 years ran continuing professional development seminars statewide under a grant we got from LEAA. We had $116,000, which was supposed to take us through 1 year of various short courses and seminars. We had several in Kenai, Ketchikan, and we went out to Bethel and Nome, lots of them in Anchorage and Fairbanks. We had good participation. We taught some of them, and we brought other experts in from around the nation to teach some. And it was very effective. Now many of the agencies are doing some of their own training, which is fine. But we can improve their skills also. But again, it takes a little increase in personnel and money in order to reach these people.
We're not really thinking about, you know, in terms of money. The thing we're going to do is cost money. We build new jails, we're going to this community corrections thing, or whatever. That's not the question. The question is, you know, what can we do that's going to be the most effective, the most bang for the buck to be, you know, by. And, that's, when you say education, for example, that's kind of really, as I used the term last night, an act of faith, right?
Yes.
I mean, education has not really proven itself to be effective very often in changing people's morals, shall we say, or things of the sort. At least just not in my observation, I'm wrong. So I really was looking for some very specific things we can do. I noticed this plan talks about effective alcohol programs. I don't know how many there are in the state that are effective. You know, so should we consider the possibility of permitting a local option prohibition? We were told in both Bethel and Nome that somewhere between 90% and 99% of the crime is alcohol related. If Village X wants to be dry, should we have a state law that says anybody who brings alcohol into that village is violating a state law and could be a felony offense? I mean, I'm looking for really specific things, and say education, maybe it's going to pay off 15 years on the road, who knows? If it's an act of faith, it's sort of real or not. But what are some concrete, specific things we can do right now, this next session, in, you know, prevention and law enforcement?
I wish I had the answer ready for you. Steve Kahn and our staff.
Well, you people are experts, right?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. If we were so expert, I guess we'd have all these answers that we could just throw out. But we're working on it, and I think we are coming up with some helpful kinds of approaches. Steve Kahn on our staff is working on a very problem you're addressing right now. He has a project that he will be completing in the next couple months. I'm not sure if he'll be ready for the session. Discussing village ordinances in relationship to alcohol problems. And my guess is that he's going to come to the same conclusion you just suggested, and that is that state law should recognize local ordinances and therefore enforce them as long as they meet state constitutional standards. So I'm saying yes, that would help from the law enforcement side, but it does nothing on the prevention side except if we assume there's a deterrence value.
Well, if it does something on the prevention side, if the people who talk to us and jump on the normal act, and they say, you know, and this is the same sort of thing that was mentioned this morning by somebody, Joe Blow is a pretty good guy. When he gets drunk and he shoots his brother, or he rapes a 11-year-old girl, or he does this, that, or the other, you know, otherwise he's okay. Now, if he can keep the alcohol away from Joe Blow, he's prevented some crime. I don't know.
Well, I do think that would help. I've seen things done in Washington State, which were pretty impressive. The state troopers and a local media person would travel the highways, and they'd stop a drunken driver, and they'd get out, and they'd go tape the guy. while the trooper interviewed him. And then they played it on the radio, just a little short segment. And that did a great deal to get people much more conscious of alcohol problems and the fact that the troopers were dealing with, the state patrol in that case, were dealing with them. So that's sort of a prevention, education, deterrent thing all wrapped into one. We could be doing those kinds of things.
Does any state already have, I'll follow Mr. Malone's question a while ago, now the same kind. Does any state have such a program which is effective for that?
Well, Washington State did. I'm not that current on what they are doing right now.
Is there any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Can I make
a final statement?
Sure. Yeah, okay. I guess what I'm concerned with, as you said earlier, I tried to say what's in the plan and present that, and some of it's going to be accepted, some of it rejected. What I'm really concerned about is that we're faced with a population increase, regardless of what we do. And I guess what I hope this committee might struggle with, or the legislature, is what are we going to do about that? What are we going to do with the increasing population? Because that's a fact. It's coming, and something has to be done. That's going to take a little time to grapple with, to struggle with. If I could, for a second, I just recommend that we can remodel and slightly add to our current facilities. For example, at Juneau and Fairbanks, we can remodel those institutions and increase their size slightly. We can add 2,000 units at Eagle River and get 80 beds there. We can double the size of Palmer at very little expense. In fact, the inmates can build it. They built the camp to begin with. My estimates and Campbell's estimates also are that we can get 200 new beds without tremendous cost, and that would help. But we'd have to start on that immediately. We're already spending $30 million on new institutions, and none of them will provide new space. So we're faced with a decision-making process right now. If we do nothing, then a year from now, perhaps 2 years from now, we're going to be faced with a crisis situation. We'll have the director of corrections fired, there'll be a governor's commission appointed to investigate, and they'll come up with new recommendations, and the same cycle will start over again. What I'm suggesting is that we can prevent that, but it does require some decision-making right now.
Well, just one final question, if I got a point. Suppose we wanted to get some new building on the street this coming summer. I'll forbid this, so we could go through something in January or February, get money appropriated. We want to go to bid, we want to go on the street in the summer. Are there standard architectural plans which could be practically taken off the shelf and used, or we got to go through this another 6 or 8 months, or whatever it takes the Department of Transportation or somebody to design the building from scratch and so forth?
There's nothing to prevent us from buying existing plans from elsewhere.
Which would work up in the last.
Absolutely. Okay. Matter of fact, we can rebuild our own models. Juneau and Fairbanks are exact duplicates of one another. We can use that same model over again. Might want to modify the dorms into single cells, but
so we could go out pretty quickly on that.
Yeah, in my opinion, what you have to do is skip DOTPF.
That's what we heard. The opinion we heard before.
Okay. Well, the other thing is that I really would like to push this, and I can't get anybody's attention, but we've got 800 bodies in our jails that we're just feeding, clothing, and giving medical attention to, and we can put those people to work.
Yes.
We can't force them to do it, but they can volunteer.
Right. Why can't we force them?
The law and the judges.
Which law?
The
U.S. Constitution says you couldn't force them. Or is there nothing I know about?
No, to be perfectly honest, what is happening is that the judicial precedents have said that we cannot force inmates to work.
But legislation makes the law.
That's right. If you pass such a law, we have it.
Thank you very much, Mr. McDonald.
Thank you.
Ms. Willing,
leave your... we do have a letter about Muriel Miller, a trooper, to the judicial council, I guess, about her letter. And a statistical analysis, a summary of findings in Anchorage and Fairbanks, and statistical analysis of misdemeanor sentences in Anchorage and Fairbanks. But maybe you might want to just run through those things just briefly, giving the highlights, and just,
Okay. Orally
sort of.
Okay. I'll try and give you the highlights.
Read them later and go in more
okay.
detail.
I'll try and give you the highlights of this analysis, and then I'll try and talk about Judge Miller's criticism of the analysis and what I think of it. Okay. We we got a grant from LEAA to analyze the plea bargaining change. This is part of the same project. Up until now, we dealt only with felonies. They gave us $300,000 for that, no state match. Then they gave us another $89,000 a year or so later, also with no state match, just to look at misdemeanor sentences alone, that they were interested in. So that's sort of a separate spin-off of it. We gathered the statistics, but we didn't have the money to do anything with them as far as analyzing them. So now we were able to analyze them. What they were particularly interested in was whether people who went to trial, as opposed to pleading guilty, got longer sentences for the same kinds of crimes by going to trial. And they also wanted to know whether the plea bargaining policy had any effect on that pattern, if there was any such pattern. So that was the primary purpose of the analysis. It wasn't a racial analysis initially. We then adapted it to the racial purpose. Are you interested in anything about the, you know, the underlying thing, or you want me to get right down to the racial aspect of it?
Well,
I'll give you some very rough generalities.
Yeah, okay, that's what I would like to know.
Okay.
It's just a matter of time.
Okay, well, roughly, there was a difference in trial plea sentences that was rather significant. People who went to trial did do worse. However, the plea bargaining policy seemed to have a good effect in that it lessened the difference between the sentences people were getting. In other words, the theory is that you should not penalize people for exercising their constitutional rights. If the acts they're committing are in fact the same acts, they ought to be treated the same way, whether or not they insist on a right to trial or whether they give up. There is that tendency to have a different type of sentence, trial and plea, and it still exists as of this date, 76. But it was improved by the plea bargaining policy. Another thing was there was a definite trend toward increasing sentences. We found that sentences did markedly rise between 1974 and 76 in the misdemeanor area, as they did in some felony areas. So there's a trend toward lengthening sentences. Now this doesn't have anything to do with race or anything like that. It's just simply an overall trend in virtually all kinds of cases. There's also a trend toward increases in fines. But in general, there's a greater increase in jail sentence. Just for example, in misdemeanor cases, the year before plea bargaining, the average jail sentence was 7.5 days. After plea bargaining, it was 11 and a third days. So from 7 to 11 is a pretty big change in 1 year jump. And you know, other changes like that. Another thing that we found is that there was a very close relationship between the number of previous convictions a person had and the length of his sentence, and that the plea bargaining policy, eliminating plea bargaining or curtailing it, had a good effect in the sense that it established a closer relationship between number of previous convictions and length of sentence. Whereas before, there was probably some bargaining away of the impact of previous convictions. The effect of previous convictions showed up much more clearly and much more consistently after the abolition of plea bargaining in the misdemeanor area. And I'll give you this report. I'm sorry I didn't make Xerox, just because I don't know why I forgot. I'll give this to Rocky. It says not for publication, preliminary draft only. You may, you know, be a little discreet about it, because
okay.
The Judicial Council hasn't had a chance to discuss it yet, but there's nothing in it that I think I can just give it to you. And
okay, thanks.
For your own usage. But if you want to publish it or reproduce it, I'd like to get the Judicial Council to approve it first. Now, out of that report, when the Supreme Court learned that we had done this work, and then the other felonies, racial stuff came out, felonies, they asked us to take a look at these misdemeanor sentences that we already had in the computer and look at them specifically for racial questions, which we hadn't done before. So we did that at the request of the Supreme Court. And we produced this report, which I have just enough copies for the people who are here. Have you seen it or gotten this report yet? Anyway, this is the report that Mary Alice was critical of. And
she wasn't criticizing the original study.
She was criticizing the one that dealt with her level of court, which was the misdemeanor level. And you got her original letter that she wrote, not the thing.
No,
that
always dealt with the newspaper.
Okay, well, her letter was a lot stronger than the newspaper article. A lot stronger. Actually, I found the letter quite offensive. I wish I had a copy, but here it is. You can read it at your leisure, but basically it said I was unethical and that I had deliberately distorted the statistics and that, you know, that I should give the taxpayers back their money because I completely cooked it up and, you know, I was to blame for this, for calling judges racist. So the newspaper article was very much less strong than the letter was. A lot of the really strong language in the letter was taken out in the newspaper article. So anyway, just going down the findings very briefly at page 5, we broke up the misdemeanor sentences, you see, between 74 and 76. Now, this was 1,795 sentences. It was a sample. It was randomly drawn by computer from Anchorage and Fairbanks convictions. These were cases that were initiated as misdemeanors and convicted as misdemeanors. There were no felony charges being reduced to misdemeanors in this sample. And our sample is overly large for the statistical purposes. It's extremely conservative in the size of the sample that we drew. And it was drawn by random numbers generated by computer. And after we had the sample, you see on table 2 and page 12, this is the start from the beginning. Page 4, table 1, just shows overall mean sentences. And with no regard to type of offense, nature of previous convictions, or anything else. Just the very first step in the analysis, it shows that blacks had an average sentence of 11 days and something, natives almost 14 days, and whites about 7.5 days. Now that doesn't prove anything, it's just a crude average, so forth and so on. The next step is we chop the data up into types of crime, classify them according to a classification system which we believe is reasonable. Mary Alice had some questions about our classification system. I'm prepared to defend it, but I don't think that you really want to get into detail of it now. But yeah. Property crimes are mostly petty larcenies. Street crimes are mostly, they include some minor drug offenses and disorderly conduct and things like that. We just use that label to lump in a whole bunch of messy little street crimes. Assault is mostly assault and battery, simple A and B. Traffic offenses are moving violations. They're not traffic tickets. They're things like reckless negligent driving and so on. Excluding ENVIs and DWIs, okay? And the breakdown on page 5 shows you which ones had statistical significance and which did not. And you see, when you have significance in an 001 level, that means there's less than one, there's one chance in 1,000 that the figures, that the breakdown is a result of chance or hazard. And the 05 level for the ENVIs is the generally accepted social science statistical significance level. 001 is much higher, of course. And you see that in the street and the assault crime, there's no statistical significance in the differences. One of her points was, she said, the report, which she calls the Rubenstein report, pointed out that there was basically no disparity in native and white assault cases. Yet, she says, how come in my bias and slanting, I didn't discuss why that was? And my answer to her was basically, that the purpose of the report wasn't to get into why the statistics showed what they did, it was merely to present them. The issues of why they come out the way they do is something that the judges and others should discuss among themselves, the Minority Sentencing Committee will discuss, the Supreme Court will discuss, the Sentencing Guidelines Committee can discuss it. All this is a report that shows the numbers. And that was my response to the Fairbanks newspaper. I also could have responded that there was no statistical significance in the differences among those offenses where you found equal treatment of natives and whites. So it happens on table 5. So that's a shorter answer to that point that you made. And you can take it all the way through. I'm not going to bore you with it, but if you just look at table 9, well, you see that on page 9, rather, table 5, you see that we dealt with natives mainly because there were many more natives in the sample than blacks. We really couldn't go too far with blacks given a few small number of convictions in the sample. But you see that the natives did have more worse prior records than whites. But the fact is, as we analyzed the data, that if you group the natives and whites by having no prior record, having a slight prior record, up to having a very severe prior record, within each prior record category, the natives still do a lot worse. For example, if you look at page 10, look at the natives and the whites with no prior record. Here you're talking about clean defendants, so let's not muddy the water. We're talking about what they may have done in the past. The whites had an average sentence of 6.05, and the natives 11, highly, you know, a significance level of 0.05, which is one chance in, what is that? I don't know. It's 10 times greater than
1 in 200, right?
Well, let's say 0.05 is 95% chance. It's a 5% chance of error. So So 0.005 would be what?
Five chances in a thousand.
Five chances in a thousand. Okay. So anyhow, you can read the report, and an interesting table is at page 13, which breaks it down by the different kinds of offenses with the mean jail sentences, native whites and the significance levels. The sentences there are shorter because the zero sentences were averaged in. See, some of the computations, we count the zeros in the figures, and sometimes we count the zeros separately as just an in-out decision. We did separate analysis on the likelihood of going to jail at all. We found that natives had a much higher likelihood of getting of going to jail, period, than in most of these offense classes, regardless of level of prior record, whether they're clean or very bad, or in the middle. A white had a much greater chance of staying out of jail altogether, getting zero. Natives had a much greater chance of getting something. So rather than average those zero sentences in with the numbers, we, in most cases, treated them separately by saying, looking at it as the in-out decision. We also averaged them in for some tables just to show you that even if you did average them in, it wouldn't change the picture. But just in case anybody thought that might make a difference, we treated them all three possible ways. And basically, the same results obtained. And the results here parallel pretty much the felony results, in the sense that we found a great deal of focus on, like, property crimes. In the felony area, that natives and blacks get treated most harshly, or the differences between white and native treatment is most apparent in property. And the same thing is true here. Least apparent in violent crimes, same thing is true with misdemeanors, which is another coincidental, maybe not coincidental thing, which to me indicates that there's some pattern. It's not just chance. Now, if you like, I won't talk any more about this report itself, and I'll discuss Judge Miller's specific points. I'll just look at her newspaper article and try and discuss each point that she makes. Okay, the first thing she says is the Michael Rubenstein study has defects of such magnitude as to cast extreme doubt in the validity of the study. Well, I disagree with that. And I suppose the rest of the things that she says are the points that she considers the defects of such magnitude. So I'll deal with those defects one by one. First, she says, it drew accusations of racial bias from judicial council members. That's not true. Judicial council members never accused judges of being racially biased as a result of the study. This didn't happen. Mary Alice Miller feels that the study implies that judges are racially biased. And her response to it has been, I am not a bigot, goddammit, and I can prove it, and the study's wrong. The Judicial Council never said that any judge was a bigot. Moreover, Mary Alice Miller, and no judge was named in the study at all. Now, Bert Campbell makes a statement, which I'm not concerned with for this purpose. Now, her points. Okay, Rubin, researchers ignored all indications of liquor involvement in arrests other than was noted in police reports. Well, in doing a study of this kind, you have to say, if you want to find evidence of a certain fact, what official document do you go to find the evidence? And we determined by looking at court files and police reports and public safety records in Juneau, there are no pre-sentence reports for misdemeanors. That information is nicely compiled in pre-sentence reports that don't exist here. You're looking at public safety records, court records, and police records. It was our determination that if you wanted to look for alcohol involvement evidence, your most consistent source of that evidence would be police reports rather than court files. I believe that is true. 47% of the cases showed a notation by the police, defendant intoxicated at the time of arrest. Okay, about 36% of that 40, most of those, were cases where alcohol was an element of the offense, like on by. That left about 11% of the balance where alcohol was not an element of the offense, but the police spontaneously reported defendant drunk. That came to about 120 or 132 cases, something like that. It's not extremely rare. However, it's much more than you have in the court records. At any rate, I don't think that the evidence of alcohol involvement in this misdemeanor sample, just partial as it is in the police reports, I mean, I know that there's not enough evidence in those police reports. I know the police don't systematically report that information. They don't because it doesn't help their case if the defendant is drunk. It may hurt their case, and it's an element of the crime. So they don't systematically report that it's true. Neither does it normally occur in the court files. So we're not happy with the evidence of alcohol involvement present in this data. However, we looked at it nevertheless because we thought, mainly on the urging of judges, that it might be a very important explaining factor. In other words, the judges were saying, it's not that the natives are native, it's that they're drunk, and it's their alcohol problem, and what we're sentencing them for their alcohol problem, and any white who had the same alcohol problem would be the same vote. Okay, that may be so. So because there was such a strong feeling in that direction, we looked at alcohol involvement given imperfect data on the point, and we acknowledged the imperfection of the data in our summary. And it's true. However, she's wrong when she says that it would be better to look in the court files. That's just wrong. And looking at the data that we have, here's what we found. That if you have a person who's drunk at the time of arrest, in general, be he white or native, we found, given the partial data and all the qualifications that I made, that his sentence was generally lower than a person who wasn't drunk. So right there, you have an indication that, well, it doesn't look like drunks are generally getting longer ones, it looks like they're generally getting shorter ones. Furthermore, if you take the drunk at time of arrest group, and you compare them white-native, you see that the native drunks get longer sentences than the white drunks. But both the native and the white drunks get shorter sentences than the non-drunk in both categories. So preliminarily, it would seem that alcohol is not the answer. Based on our partial data with all the caveats, we don't believe so far that you're going to find the explanation for the disparity in alcohol, but we're going to continue to look for it, to look for the explanation. But she's wrong when she says that this was a distortion, that we did something wrong, I believe. No attempt was made to determine from the local case file a defendant's prior record. Instead, only centralized juvenile file for use. In the letter that I gave Mr. Parr, which was a lot more strongly worded and more detailed than this article, she said that the Fairbanks clerk's office keeps their own local records of previous convictions, and then it's her experience that if a guy is arrested in Fairbanks and they look at the local file, there'll be many more previous convictions in that file noted for that defendant than would appear in the official records in Juneau. And the Juneau records are, quote, woefully inadequate, and that's what she said, and therefore Rubenstein, once again, was unethical or slanting his study by using the official records. So my answer to her was, first of all, we use official records, not unofficial records. If you're studying Anchorage and Fairbanks, you can't use unofficial records for Fairbanks and official records for Anchorage. You have to use official records for both sources. If you use different data sources for different cities and you're trying to do a uniform study, that's bad practice. Second of all, and I think the bottom line is that let us concede that the Juneau records are woefully inadequate. Let's concede that there's many more convictions that would have shown up if we used our local files. Even doing so, I know of no reason to believe that the Juneau official records would be racially biased. In other words, if they're inadequate, if they show not enough convictions, then they would show not enough convictions for natives as well as for whites. So as long as we use the same uniform record source, it shouldn't make any difference in the finding of disparity. We're using a uniform official source for all records, and the result should stand on its own regardless of whether she has an independent source. And the study did not include information on prior alcohol treatment programs given the defendant in other sentences. True, it didn't, and she should tell us where we ought to get that information because it's not contained in police reports. It usually isn't contained in court files. There are no pre-sentence reports on the matter, and in dealing with misdemeanor cases, you're severely limited in your sources of information. Dealing with felony cases, we have that data. We have it for 1976-79. We'll analyze it. We recognize that it's good to have. It's just not available uniformly in her court. And then she says there's no attempt to analyze cases to determine why judges who appear unbiased in one type of crime are biased in another type of crime. That's the point she made about no disparity in the assault cases. We noted that, but we didn't say why. Answer is, we don't say why anywhere in the report. We just say what is, not why. And number two, the absence of disparity in assault crimes is not statistically significant, whereas the disparity that appeared in the other areas was statistically significant. So, I mean, that's the answer there. That's about it. That's what she says.
Let me ask you a couple of questions, Mr. Rubenstein. Number one, I guess, do you think it's true that the records in Juneau are less complete than those in the local? is there a practice of sending all these things down to email for central files? You know? It's nothing to do with Libya or Ford.
Yeah, yeah.
You might just want to touch on that one. Do you know?
I don't know for a fact, but I will take her word for it.
I can make a note on that. Let's find out what's happening so we'll know where that information is being sent. No, I don't know if it is or not.
I suspect there's a time lag involved. I think that's what it is more than anything.
Well, we'll find out. I think it's something really more. Second thing, though, your report is aimed at, and these are the figures that the data reveals to us, right? Okay. Whose job is it, or who is going to do it, if anybody, the job of determining whether, no, not whether, why a judge, let's say, a fixed judge X, consistently gave relatively equal sentences for assault and didn't give consistently equal sentences for some other kinds. Now, judicial counsel, you simply made a statistical study, and then you said very clearly about three times, that is not your function to say why. So who is looking into the why?
Well, the Minority Sentencing Committee is looking into why. And I suspect that they will report to the legislature in February and tell you what their opinion is on why.
Has this research been expanded to get breakdowns on the sentencing patterns of individual judges? So we can say that Judge X has a clear presence pattern and Judge Y does not, or is it still gross?
I would be lying to you if I told you that we couldn't go to the computer and identify individual judges and put numbers next to the names of those judges. Because we have the capability of doing that.
You have the tagging system.
We have the tagging system that enables us to do that. The reason why we haven't done that is that when you're dealing with a relatively small number of cases, and we're always dealing with a relatively small number of cases in Alaska by virtue of our relatively small caseload in Alaska, and even in the felony study where we capture the entire universe, in other words, we'll capture every single felony sentence, not a sample, every one of them. If you then divide those felonies, I'm sorry to be long-winded, but I have to tell you why I'm not giving you the judge's name. I think it's important. Everybody asks for this. You divide those felony sentences by type of crime, property, drug, violence, etc. You get five or six classifications. Then within each classification, you divide it by how many previous convictions the defendant had. Zero, more than one, felony, misdemeanor, mixed, whatever. Classifications like that. Then you ask, did the defendant have a weapon? How much property did he steal? And there are certain basic questions that you would want to ask before you say that sentence group X is unjustifiably disparate from sentence group Y.
Yeah, and
then you divide it by the number of judges and you get into two small figures.
Well, that's what you're saying is your sample to be too small to be statistically valid, that's what you're saying.
To talk about an individual judge.
Very simple.
Right.
Okay. Wouldn't it be worthwhile to do this thing and break it down like that would be primary heading being the name of the judge and with the appropriate breakdown you run through there, at least for the purpose of that, having it looked at by, and I'm saying this deliberately because obviously they all follow it, other explanations, you don't want to single out some judge and accuse that person of being biased, but to at least to furnish that, say, to the Supreme Court or to the whoever else might be appropriate.
That's been done.
That has been done.
And it was done on a very confidential basis, and I'll tell you something. We were looking for a pattern of finding a couple of bad apples. Mm-hmm. That the judges said, identify the bad apples and exonerate me. Mm-hmm. And we said, I think that you'll more likely find a consistent pattern running through the entire system of people unconsciously or consciously reflecting their general attitudes and their sentencing practices, and you find that more people are unconsciously prejudiced than you believe. Well, I think that the latter is the case. I think that in all probability, I think that we have reason to believe that what we're seeing here is a general systemic pattern rather than something which is influenced by a couple of bad apples.
Okay, now, to whom was this report furnished? To
it was furnished only to Chief Justice Rabinowitz.
Okay.
And he I don't know, he may have furnished it himself to others. I suspect that he furnished it to Mary Alice Miller. I don't know.
The thing is, it has been done, and the Chief Justice has had an opportunity to look at it. And you're, say, summing it up very simply, it's something that cuts across and does not indicate that Judge X was consistently biased and Judge Y was consistently unbiased.
In effect, you said
systemic, you said it cuts across the cross.
Pretty widespread.
I'm not saying there would be any disparities, but I'm saying you're saying that no disparities which are, let's say, sufficiently grave to single out a particular judge as being biased.
Well, you could say that there were many which were sufficiently grave to produce the general pattern.
I mean,
that few were not.
More than the other run of judges I'm driving at.
Nobody stood out. Nobody stood out like a sore thumb.
Okay, that's what I'm asking. Okay, thank you. I want to dig that out of you. Mr.
Chairman, as I understood the Rubenstein's previous comments, is that one of the problems in that analysis was that maybe I misunderstood it. That, but on a breakdown of the basis, the potential becomes less reliable, and so you might have, you know, looking at the method of analysis, then you can have relatively few samples. And then if you did take perhaps the trouble to look into specific cases that might have resulted in that, you'd possibly come up with what, you know, maybe some people regard as a logical explanation and a bias. And so when you break it down that far, the reliability drops significantly.
Right. I wouldn't use the word reliability. I would say that when you're looking at statistical evidence and you try to extrapolate from a statistic to an individual case,
cases handled by an individual judge.
Cases handled by an individual judge. If one individual judge only sentenced six natives in a particular year, in a violent crime category, let's say, Could you look at that judge and say, Judge, on the basis of those six natives that you sentenced for violent crimes, whose sentences were much longer than the 50 whites that you sentenced, you are prejudiced. The judge could then look at those six native cases, and he could go down each case and show you a specific factor in each of those six cases which justified him in his mind in distinguishing the six from the 50. Now, the six may have gotten 100% longer sentences than the 50. And that pattern shows up in a lot of places, then you say, oh, there's something wrong here. But if it's just this guy's six cases, what can you say?
But, Mr. Chairman, but then going back to the analysis, the sentencing analysis, across the state, though, that this misdemeanor analysis and then felonies, if you look at the numbers, it indicates that if there is a bias, whatever sort of reason, that it more than likely is a system-wide bias, not
something you can point to one particular judge and say, if you straighten this guy out, we wouldn't have a problem in the state. You don't have that kind of situation.
I think I'm an awful lot of questions I want to ask, but I might get them all the answers anyway, and I'd rather wait on the report to see
what I had another. I'd like to, but might turn to another topic. It seemed that you told us, I'm not sure when it was, and I'll be back, 1st September or sometime, that you were going to have some, this work that you're doing is also going to give us some pretty detailed information which might help out in the drug situation. Mm-hmm. Do you have that yet? Or?
Not yet, but we will have it. The work that we were doing involved felony sentences rendered in all 10 Superior Court locations between 76 and 79, summer of 79. And for every drug felony sentence between that in that period, we'll have the type of drug and the quantity of the drug and a whole lot of facts about the defendants.
You have any idea about when it's
We're shooting for January. We'll try and have it by the opening of the legislative session.
You're also doing a study on bail?
The consultant who was worked with us on a number of our studies, not this one, but the felony one, is doing a study on bail for the court system. And preliminarily, he's told me that the results of that study show natives staying in jail longer than whites for the same crime. But I'm too sketchy on that study. It's not.
You know when that study is likely to be ready.
Very soon. He has a preliminary draft. On bail, if I just make this one point, we met with the district judges. The Minority Sentencing Committee met with district judges in Anchorage, who have, by the way, been very cooperative and very helpful and very interested in the whole process, unlike the Fairbanks judges. And they met with the committee for a couple of hours, and they pointed out something that was very interesting. That a lot of these misdemeanor statistics, they believe, and I think they're right, can be explained by disparities in the bail process rather than the sentencing process. In other words, natives who have to spend time in pretrial detention when whites make bail or get released on their own recognizance, by the time these natives come to court, they've already done a week or two. If they plead guilty, the judge sentences them to time already served. So in effect, they're doing their sentences before they've been found guilty, where the whites are getting bailed out. And I think that the study that's being done by the court system will tend to substantiate that what the judges have said.
And this sort of relates to both areas, and I expect a complete answer now, but just to find out where the information will be developed. In this statistical analysis, and another statistical analysis that are prepared, that are broken down along racial lines, is there any way of correlating that with the income levels of the people who receive sentences? Is there any way that the data can be collected and applied so that, well, if there is a correlation, it might possibly be discovered? Because that's a question I want to ask to the commission and the community report, but I just have a feeling in the back of my mind that a lot of people that are looking at the longer sentences here are probably also in the lower income bracket.
Yeah. We did that already.
And that may reflect not so much possibly, because we explored it, any sort of perhaps nothing on the part of the judges at all, but on the whole access to justice that exists in that system.
Well, in the felony area, in the previous felony study that we did, which was much more sophisticated and fancy than this one, mainly because we had a lot more to analyze, and there were pre-sentence reports available. We did look at the income level of the defendant, and that information is gathered by Alaska Pretrial Services, which makes recommendations to judges on bail. And we were able to get income. We were also able to get occupation, employment history, educational level, a whole lot of other socioeconomic factors. And we did multiple regression analyses, which determined whether or not each and any one of those things, had an independent relationship with fluctuations in length of sentence. And we did find that in certain kinds of crimes, there was a very direct relationship between monthly income and length of sentence. You could go, one by $200 increments, you could show an association by monthly income and length of sentence. Also, employment patterns, type of occupation, all these things in certain, there's no across-the-board answer to each individual type of felony. The pattern is violent crimes, drug crimes, property crimes. You see very different patterns in all three. So, for example, in drug crimes, very heavy relationship between socioeconomic facts and length of sentence.
My main question is, the data are available.
They are available, and race stood out independently of those factors. In other words, we could isolate income away and say race still comes through. Now, this misdemeanor report does not go into that kind of detail.
Thank you. Would it be possible also in the community, there's a database here and got everything all set up to the extent, is it possible to plug in the kind of representation of the defendant had as well.
Yes.
I think it's 50 a public defender versus private attorney.
We did that in the felony.
Was there any correlation?
Yes, there was.
Very strong. Correlation.
Very strong
more
negative.
More likely to be convicted or what?
More likely to get a long sentence, especially in crimes of property. A property crime defendant represented by the public defender independently of the other variables showed a strong negative, a strong positive association with sentence length.
Your study did not go into, it went into sentence length, but not into your chances of conviction, am I correct?
No, not chances of conviction.
No, there's no data available.
There is data.
Which would be suitable for that kind of a check.
There is.
My question is, I'm pretty obviously where I'm going, is there a likelihood that if I can't afford a private lawyer and I have to go to public defender, I'm more likely to be convicted?
I don't know the answer to your question, but we do have the data which makes it possible to analyze that question. Mm-hmm. I'm not altogether satisfied with it, though. So I would say that we would like to get a little more data, but there is something. You can start to answer that question.
We won't be able to go much longer because there's somebody else coming in.
And
to answer
that question that's not related to the report, are you familiar with what is better known as the new screening process that we have now instead of our plea bargaining?
I think I know what you're referring to. I'm not positive. You mean the pretrial screening project with the defendant? Do they think of it as something accepted to plea bargaining?
Well, it's not necessarily the way that they think it's something that's come up in the hearings, and I'd be very interested in getting a copy of what they're using.
I'm sure they could supply it to you. I don't really know. It's run out of the DA's office here in Anchorage, and I'm sure the DA's would be happy to send give you a copy of their criteria.
Excuse me for just a minute. Are you talking about the pretrial intervention thing? Because I think Ramona's talking about what people call charge bargaining
charge
rather
bargaining.
Than plea bargaining.
Charge bargaining.
Oh, that's not assist. That's an old time minor thing that's always existed and still existed. And the plea bargaining policy didn't really have much of an effect on that. It's not an institutional thing. It's something that's informally done by lawyers, and they never stopped doing it. And Ambrose's policy didn't change it in any way. He hoped that it would, but it really didn't happen.
Well, when this first came up, to my knowledge, with the gnome, and when I specifically asked the question, do you have the directives on charge bargaining? Is that the word that we use?
Charge bargaining is the right term.
Yeah.
Okay. I was told no, that they didn't have the directives, but had memos on it, and I haven't been able to.
I can give you the memos on that.
Sure
there's one memo on plea bargaining, and basically what the memo on charge bargaining says is this. It says that you can adjust the charges, you can dismiss some charges and keep other charges, you can reduce charges from the original charge. You can do all the things that you always used to do, except you may not do them in exchange for the defendant's agreement to enter a plea. In other words, Mr. Prosecutor, you look at your file, and if you think that the defendant has too many charges against him or the charges are too high, go ahead and lower them. And if the defendant decides that he wants to go ahead and plead guilty when you do, that's his business. But you are not lowering those charges or reducing those charges, dismissing charges, because the defendant has agreed to plead guilty. You're doing them because you think, in your professional judgment, is the right thing to do. It's independent. It's not a bargain. It's a unilateral action on your part. And that's what the policy says.
Well, I guess I got something more out of it than that too, because I specifically asked this question to the DA at Maine. And the reason why I was terribly interested at that time, still am, that charges of rape had been changed from rape to assault and battery and from rape to losing a civil conduct. And I'd be real interested in seeing the policies that cover something like
that. Perhaps Rocky can get that for us.
I'll give Rocky the memo, but the memo was no more specific than what I just said.
Well, I understand that there's a book, I heard it, a different book. It's about the six, it covers this book.
Maybe it's something new, I don't know,
yeah.
I don't know what it is.
I don't like to sudden Rubenstein off, but Mr. Mandel is here waiting, and he's kind of so due, so thank you very much.
Thank you very much
for
inviting me,
Mr.
Chairman.
We'll look forward to that information as it develops.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Mandel?
We've been running a little behind. I did mail the legislative implication thing to everybody and totally got it.
Okay. Let's see. It says here, corrections master plan and site selection for Tucson facility and one institution to replace with you.
It's quite a load.
Well.
I think we did get some, a copy of, you did this, I believe.
Yes.
Right, this is the legislative implication of the master plan.
Right.
Okay. First of all, I understood from John Angel, who was here earlier today, or someone, that there was some misunderstanding about what the actual correctional master plan is. This is one of the summaries prepared by...
Summary, right.
Right. This is the actual correctional master plan. It's over 600 pages in length. It's voluminous. So what I was asked to do for the legislature was prepared. Initially in July, I prepared a short summary to try to tell people what was in it in the draft stage. And then more recently, the second summary, which is strictly a legislative summary, that is the implications for legislation that are contained in the plan. I don't know whether you've had time to read it, but
I have gotten it.
The green cover?
No, no orange cover either.
Not one of these?
You should have. I got
one. Yeah, I've mailed them to everybody.
Yeah, I may have gotten one.
Now, you didn't take a position in the legislative implications. You simply went through the thing and said, if the plan were to be accepted as it stands, more or less,
exactly.
This is what it implies in terms of work for legislature.
That's exactly right. Well, if you'd permit me, I didn't know how formal or informal this committee meeting might be. I prepared a statement here. Maybe I can share that with
you.
Go ahead. Okay. In April of 1978, I completed a study for the legislature on the Alaska Division of Corrections. In the preface to that study, which again was almost 2 years ago, I indicated that large sums of money had been directed toward researching correctional problems. The projects included $33,000 for an Anchorage pretrial detention study, $50,000 for development of phase one of the master plan, $143,000